Welcome to Energy in Action. I'm your host, Marcy Young, and as a Mito patient myself, I appreciate you and the community you've helped us to build. This podcast honors the triumphs and struggles of patients and families affected by this disease and celebrates the work being done by doctors and researchers every day to make it a safer world for our people. We are a support group and a podcast focusing on all things related to mitochondrial disease. Welcome to another episode of Energy in Action. I welcome you, and I am joined by two wonderful women today to talk about a topic that has been hot on my mind since I got involved with MitoAction a couple years ago. It is something that I battle with all day. I think about it before I go to bed. It's one of the first things I think about when I wake up. And that topic is talking to my kids about my disease. I've talked about it here and there within different episodes in the past, but today we are going to get heavy on the topic with Devin Schumann, who is a genetic counselor and a Mito patient herself, and Sam Phyllis, who is a Mito mom and struggling with the disease herself as well. So struggling and championing. So welcome, ladies. Thank you so much for you both being here.
Nice to see you again.
Yeah, thanks for inviting us.
Of course. Yes, Devin has been on the show recently. You've learned a lot about the state of the Mito world from Devin. And today we're going to get into a much more specific topic. So I feel like I'm going to benefit just as much as all of our listeners today. I'm really looking forward to getting into some of these questions. So before we get started, though, you all know Devin. Sam, tell us about you for a couple minutes.
Okay, so I am 33 and I have been struggling with Mito for most of my life, but it's been kind of at the front of my life for the better part of 20, 25 years now, starting with gastroparesis and kind of progressing more from there. And we didn't really realize how it would play into our children until our first daughter was born. And our children also have a separate genetic condition called spinal muscular atrophy. And so that was something that we realized our children were born in the pre-treatment era of that disease. And so that kind of, that's a whole different story and it's a very complicated one, but that we were told for our oldest daughter that she would live about 2 years and she lived 3 months. And so when she was alive, we were kind of thinking that there was something else kind of playing a role in her disease process. And it became more glaring as we had more children that there was something else genetic at play. And so as we've had more children, we've realized that mitochondrial disease is probably playing a role. For instance, my second daughter had seizures, and that was something that we just completely out of the blue didn't realize. You know, we thought, okay, well, you have this genetic thing, we couldn't possibly have more. Yeah, we were wrong. And so as we've gotten, you know, we've had 4 children since our oldest, and our other daughters with spinal muscular atrophy are now 6 and 1. And it seems like at least 4 out of our 5 children have had some sort of mitochondrial involvement. So apparently our genetics with Mito are at play more than we realized. And then professionally, I've been a nurse for, let's see, started in 2013, so it'll be 12 years now. And then I was a CNA for 7 years prior to that. So I've been in the field for almost 20 years. So my career has changed a great deal because of my disease. So when I started in long-term care, working on a busy unit, taking care of, you know, 30 plus patients, and now I take care of one. So yeah, my life has changed a great deal because of my disease.
Well, thank you for sharing that. I feel you, and I know how hard it is to talk about all of these things, especially with a group of people that you're not even sure who they all are. So I appreciate your bravery, and I can't wait to hear more about your beautiful children. So I sometimes get the feeling that I
am being judged for having a genetic condition and continuing to decide to have children. Devin, maybe you can kick this one off. Should someone with a mitochondrial disease forego having kids?
I mean, the short answer is as a genetic counselor, one, our field tends to be kind of, we try to be non-directive. So our whole field as a general basis tends to start with, we're not going to tell you what to do. We're going to tell you what your options are. That's gone a little bit away in like cancer genetics. We're like, no, we're going to tell you, please have your mammograms. But in the prenatal world, I think that really does still ring true. And especially as a genetic counselor that I have mito as well. Mine's autosomal recessive, like SMA is, that Sam was talking about. So both my parents carried it and they passed it down to me, though they didn't know that at the time. And then if I were to have kids, they would not have symptoms unless I magically found a reproductive partner who also carried the same form of mito. But I didn't know that when I was first diagnosed. I didn't know what my genetic origin was for my mito. So I didn't know if it was a 0 to 100% chance I'd pass it down. And I think that always has affected me talking to patients, because I've always been like, no, I'm not going to tell you what's the right decision for you, because there isn't a right decision or a wrong decision. And we also only can go off of the knowledge we have in a moment. And we know that knowledge is going to be wrong, straight up wrong, probably in 20 years, both from things like what are treatments available, but also things like what we think we understand about a condition and what it might look like is very different as we learn more over the years. We might think you only have symptom A, and later we're like, you can have symptoms A through Z. But also, we only know so much about ourselves, right? Like when we talk about, should someone with mito have kids, that person isn't just mito, right? Like their genetics have 20,000 other genes that are playing a role in other conditions that you might not realize are running through your family, or genes and environment all playing a role together. And so I talk about this to a lot of people. So like, oh, so we're good to go because we don't carry the same thing. Like for that one thing, yes. For the other 20,000, who knows? I joke that parenting, and I haven't been a parent, so you guys can tell me if this is totally wrong, but I joke that you just jump off a cliff eventually and see what happens. You can get all your little parachutes lined up, but you just have to leap.
Mm-hmm. Every day feels like that.
Exactly, right? And so I think people can be like, especially before a first kid, no, we're going to do everything perfectly. I'm like, breaking news, there's no perfect, and you just have to leap and cross your fingers and hope you deal with it well on the way down, right? Like, and so no, I don't think we should say people with mito shouldn't have kids. I don't think we should say anyone should or shouldn't have kids. You might rule out one thing and rule in five others that cause other issues. Like it's not as simple as I think we'd love for it to be. People want to write a wrong answer. That's not medicine. That's definitely not parenting.
I think this is important advice for people to hear, for people in our community to hear. Sam, how do you, I mean, you've had kids.
Yeah. I've had a lot of kids. I've had five.
Do you feel like people have commented to you? I have a story that I'll get to in a few, but I want to hear from you.
Yeah. I feel like especially after we lost our oldest, I remember one of my friends asked me, so you're adopting now, right? And I was like, oh, okay. So this is how it's going to go. And it was just very odd because I was just like, okay, so I don't get to have natural children anymore because I have a child that has a genetic condition. And that was just SMA. At that point, we didn't, you know, we knew that I had a genetic thing, but we didn't realize that Amelia also had it. That's my oldest daughter. And as things continued, you know, people kept saying, okay, so you're done now, right? Like each kid, it was, you're done now, right? You've had, like, after we had Lydia, who didn't have SMA, my second daughter, it was like, okay, so you had your normal child. And I was just like, wow, okay, so this is where we're going to go with that. And yeah, it was very unfortunate. It made me feel like my children with disabilities and my children with mito were less. And unfortunately, however that looks, you know, people think because Lydia is more functional than my other children that are disabled, that, you know, she's worth more because she's able to walk and talk like other kids. And she is affected by Mito. And people don't realize it because she's able to mask. So, yeah, I definitely felt a lot of judgment. And at a certain point, you just have to say, hey, you know, I understand that you have your opinions, and respectfully, your opinions don't matter in this situation. The only opinions that truly matter are mine and my husband's. And that's where we're going with this. And so as we continued to build our family, we just kept talking to each other and making sure that we were on, you know, the same page with things. And then, you know, when we had our youngest, it was like, yep, we're done. We're happy with where our family is at. Obviously missing our oldest and wishing that she could still be with us. But, you know, we're like, yep, we're happy with the size of our family now. And we were content with that.
Having nothing to do with the disabilities.
I always say to patients when they ask me, like, what should I do? I'm like, it's not my baby. It's not my body. My opinion doesn't matter.
When I looked into first getting pregnant, it was probably around 2010, and it was going to be upwards of $40,000 for one opportunity for my embryo and my husband's sperm to go to a lab in Detroit and hopefully it be successfully implanted in me. They couldn't tell me what percentage chance that this would be a successful operation. And we didn't have that kind of money in general, much less to put forth to, you know, when I was, you know, in my late 20s, having no symptoms yet. So it felt really tough to say that this was so necessary when I had lived, you know, a more able-bodied life through that point. So we thought, well, we can either pay for their college one day, or we can at least help, you know, assist with that, or we can do this and take out loans and never be the same financially.
It's one of my biggest pet peeves that doctors tell patients all the time, oh, well, if you carry something or you have something, Jack, you can just do IVF.
Yeah, that's a simple solution.
Right.
Everyone says that. And I'm like, it's not a quick weekend project, folks. Like, it's not a, hey, let's build a shelf together. Yeah. It's higher than a college tuition. It's invasive. There's medications and drugs and things that not everyone is
what
capable of.
What if that affects the mitochondrial condition? Who knows?
Exactly. And so many patients, it's thrown around like this is easy. And then they go to talk to someone and they're like, okay, I sort of get part of it. And I'm like, and do you know that if you want to test the embryos for what you have, sometimes we have to go test your parents to track it through the generations. And that's thousands of dollars on top of baseline IVF costs. And everyone's like, what? It takes a year. It takes a college tuition. And it might not even be possible for all mutations. But we throw it around like a quick, easy solution, just like for you, Sam. Oh, you're going to adopt now, right? Since when is adoption quick, easy solution either? That's a huge decision.
And a lot of people weigh in, and sometimes it's hard not to take it personally, you know?
Right. Yeah. No,
I can sit here and agree with you both and feel really strong in what I'm saying. But in the everyday world, you can get gut punched, you know?
Oh, yeah, for sure.
Yeah, I've had even professionals. I was at a meeting with a genetic testing company once. We had a dinner. And there's maybe a little bit of wine involved in this one staff member, but she just was harping on the fact that none of the people at the meeting who worked in genetics had kids yet. And she's like, oh, but you're going to want to. And I was like, I haven't decided yet what I want to do for that. They're like, oh, no, you're gonna want to. And we like tried tactfully to dodge it. And finally, one of my coworkers was like, she has a genetic condition. And they were like, you're gonna want to. And it was just so funny to have the opposite, right? Because usually people are like, oh, you have something, you won't have kids. And this person's like, no, trust me, your uterus needs a baby. And I'm just like, this is highly inappropriate.
Right.
It was like a weird gut punch to have to like interrupt a drunk person to be like, actually, like, watch what you're saying, please. This is okay.
a professional.
Exactly. Like, and that's not even family. Family's
right. Right. Family's a lot.
Talk about emotions.
Right. Right. So I was having a really bad flare up with back pain and went in for a steroid injection, and it was an outpatient procedure. But I was going to need anesthesia, and I always like to talk to the anesthesiologist about my condition. It's a very quick procedure, so it's nothing that my neurologist gets too, you know, fired up about. But I do always tell the nurse, you know, I want to see the anesthesiologist before I go under. So she goes, can I ask why? And, you know, she's putting an IV in me. The ball's in her court, right? I'm just laying there. And so I just casually said, you know, I have a genetic condition and it's something I want to mention to the anesthesiologist. And she starts weighing in. And she and I gave her some details about, you know, that it's a mitochondrial disease. And she goes, well, you must have been diagnosed after you had your kids, because we had already talked about how I have two kids. And she said that, and I'm laying there. I'm so excited to get this steroid injection because I'm in so much pain and have been for months, laid up in bed. I'm so happy to just get to the finish line here. And then she says that to me, and I'm like, you are a medical professional and you're going to weigh in such a aggressive way to me. And I think about her comment from time to time, and I'm sad that I do. I wish I didn't give it that energy, but it, you know, people don't think, I guess.
No, I don't think people do think at all. It's sad, unfortunately.
Yeah, it can be bad. And I also have people in my village that really take good care of my feelings. So it's not all bad, but sometimes you do, you know, when you have such a precarious situation, which, you know, everyone does in some way or another, when that chord is struck, it can feel really tough, you know. Sam, I'm curious to talk to you about talking with your kids about your illness. Do they know that you are suffering?
It's hard with the ages of my kids. My oldest is 7 and my youngest is 1. So obviously I'm not talking to my 1-year-old, because my 1-year-old literally says bye-bye and that's about it. My 7-year-old is very sensitive. She's very tender-hearted, and she's like the sweetest kid you'll ever meet. Lydia is the one that, like, if I'm having a bad day, she's the first one to notice, aside from my husband. So, you know, she'll be like, Mommy, are you okay? Like, do you need to sleep? Do you need to rest? Like, I think you should be in bed, kind of thing. So she is like my little mother hen. And being the oldest child, that's very typical. So I'm a little more upfront with her about that, just because she's old enough to understand and recognize it. But do I go into like specific detail about it yet? No. When it comes to her sister, I do a little bit more, because obviously she knows that her older sister died. And she knows that her other two sisters had the same condition. And so the risk of them dying is very serious. And so we do have to have those conversations, and they're not easy conversations to have. And so there are very similar conversations that do happen about like how severe their genetic conditions are. And there's a lot of overlap between spinal muscular atrophy and mitochondrial disease and how they affect our bodies. It's just that my children are affected very severely by SMA at this point. And their mitochondrial disease makes that more glaring. So whereas most kids that are treated with SMA, now they do better, my kids tend to do a little differently just because of their separate genetic conditions. So because of that, we do have to have more direct conversations about, hey, you know, these are serious. And like when Nora goes to the hospital, my 6-year-old, my daughter Lydia gets very worked up and very upset and says, you know, I need to make sure Nora's okay. And the last time Nora was in the hospital, she actually stayed home from school. And this kid lives to go to school. Like, if we have a snow day, she's like, Mom, can you go open the school? And she said, no, Mom, I need to go see my sister at the hospital because I need to make sure she's okay. So that kind of conversation happens pretty frequently in our house just because of that. And so as time goes on and as my disease progresses, I'm sure those conversations will have to happen more frequently and I'm less able to hide. You know, I'm very used to masking, both being autistic and having mitochondrial disease. And so as things have gotten worse, I'm less able to do that. And it's, I think, just being a child of the 90s, especially, like, we didn't get diagnosed with autism until we were in our 20s or later. And then, you know, having chronic conditions like this, you're just taught that, you know, you keep going until you can't go anymore.
Right.
And
right.
That's such a toxic way to live life. And I'm, you know, 33 now. And I'm like, you know, I'm not doing that anymore. And so I have to kind of change my mental like thinking into that, my approach. Definitely.
I mean, so for context, Sam and I became friends, like really close, video chatting for like 4 to 8 hours in a day at one point. I'm trying to remember, was it right before your first ever pregnancy or was it really during your first pregnancy that we started video chatting?
I think it was during my first pregnancy.
Probably. Yeah, I want to say it was like, we were talking about pregnancy stuff when I was in school becoming a general counselor. And so like we just started talking all the time and I'd be writing a thesis while she's taking care of a kid. And so like we would video chat for hours, but it's just been interesting because like our friendship has really been first pregnancy, second, like all of these things Sam's talking about is like the arc of our friendship too, in a lot of ways. And so it's like, we didn't know each other before I was a GC or before she had Mita. Like we've only known this version of each other. But like, it's been so interesting for me to also watch like Lydia grow up and be so attuned to it. And like we're video chatting and she's like coming in, jumping on her mom, being like, mom, go to bed. But she wants to talk to Devin right now. but like also, I mean, there was like 6 months there that every time she came in, she'd be like, my sister's in heaven. And I'm like, yeah, I know. And I love her. Yeah. And she hyperfixated on that for 6 months. And I remember at the time we talked about how like other people like would judge you because she was talking about it. Like that was a sign that like you shouldn't have said something to her, you know, and it was like, or she's a toddler, young child, and the young childs have fixations on lots of things and big emotions about what color crayon they're using. And we shouldn't be scared of the kids' big emotions about a big topic. We're not scared of their big emotions about little topics either. Like that's kids. And the fact that she kept bringing it up was a sign that she was processing it, you know, and it was integrating into her understanding of the world. And that's not a bad thing. And I just had so much respect for Sam for not like trying to brush it away or trying to hide it or, you know, subdue the child talking about it and being like, well, we don't talk about that in front of others, which sadly, a lot of people instinctually do that for kids for any big topic. Like, oh, that's not a topic around other people. But like, what does that say about Millie? Right? Or what does that say about your daughter of like, oh, well, we shouldn't talk about her? Like, that's not a good message either. Like, but people don't think about that side of it. They're like, oh, I might be uncomfy, so I don't want to hear it. So you should talk about it. Instead of, well, what is that telling Lydia about her sister? That we shouldn't talk about her? Like, well, that's nonsense. But it's just interesting and sad. And I want to hop through the computer and yell at people that Sam tells me about all the time. But that's not a possibility.
So, you know, Lydia has a lot on her plate, a lot to think about, you know, with her siblings and knowing that her older sister is gone, you know, in this physical space. I grew up with a lot of worry. I knew my mom also had this disease and died of it when she was 60. My grandma had it. My aunt has it. My aunt had it, never diagnosed, but that's a whole other topic. Lots of cousins have it. So my family is kind of immersed in it. And I grew up very scared. We didn't have our genetic diagnosis at that point, but I knew there was something very wrong with my mom. I'm I think I'm doing a little bit better than she was doing at this time, but I grew up with so much just fear and worry, and I'm scared to put that on my kids. But I'm also keeping something from them, and I try to be as open with them about big topics. We talk about a lot of things. And my son lost one of his best friends to leukemia last year. I mean, we've had to talk about death and illness and you know, a lot. And I'm not scared of the topics by any means. I just, something about talking about this condition, that it runs through the family, that's what's really a big hang up for me. I think if it was something that just I had, but there wasn't necessarily a direct connection to them, you know, a strong possibility of them having it, I think I'd be more comfortable talking about it. So they know I have back pain. They know I have, you know, all these different things. And I think they just think I'm a mess, but there's not anything, you know. Devin, do you have a patient that has spoken to you in this way? What are some of your takeaways?
All the time. Right? Because there isn't a right answer. And that's the hard part.
No, I know.
You want the right answer, because then you follow the prescription and you do what they say to do in this order. I have always defaulted to open and honest is best, because one, kids are smart. And they pick up on things that you never think that they'd be able to pick up on. Kind of like when you grew up, you didn't have a name for it, but you figured out, hey, a lot of people in my family have this. Like, you knew that there was a chance there before anyone probably explicitly told you there was. And to me, I do think I see a lot of, from the patient side, provider, I mean, I see a lot of patients who come to me as young adults, like in their 20s, who A, have no idea the condition that they even have, or B, have no idea the condition that's in their family. Either they don't know the name, no one's ever told them how it was inherited, no one's told them the range of symptoms. So I've had people that come to me being like, yeah, I want to get tested for what my brother has. And I'm talking to them and they obviously have it too, but they didn't realize those symptoms were caused by the same thing. Kind of like with Mito, you kept so many different flavors of it. And it's a weird conversation to be like, so I'm not your family and I don't know what you've been told by other providers, but you know you have this, right? Right? And like trying to ease into that, usually way less bluntly. And I see how often this happens. Or young adults, they go to genetics and people didn't want to have the hard conversations. They don't know they have an intellectual disability. They don't know that it could get passed down. They don't know that something like pregnancy could make their symptoms worse. And they're figuring it out on their own, either because family members still won't talk about it, because people have passed away, because people have moved away. Like, we don't know what's coming. Usually nobody's saved records of anything. So I'm always like, save copies of everything. Because sometimes I'm trying to figure it out too. I'm like, I don't even know what you have because nobody told you and nobody kept records. And that puts people, I've seen it go both directions. The people who never had kids because they were sure it would get passed down when it wouldn't. And now they're past the age at which they want to have kids. And they're like, I didn't do that because of a misconception. Or the opposite, they didn't have the opportunity to know what the different options were. And they're like, I really wish I'd known those options and had time to think about them. And I mean, again, I always say knowledge of your genetics doesn't change your genetics. If you were born with this chance, you were born with it. When you find out about it, it's not changing your reality. It's just changing your knowledge of your reality. Like, your future was always what it was going to be to some extent, right? Like, you were always going to develop the syndrome if you have the change. You just now know that it's coming.
But can a kid process that?
Again, I think it depends on kind of like any big topic with kids, even like consent, right? What do you talk about first? Consent for hugging a family member, right? Like, you start with, kind of like Sam was saying, you start with, yeah, you know that I deal with this stuff. You know what this is. You know the term gastroparesis? Maybe not, but you get like, mom has issues with eating that she has to deal with. And you slowly build on that. I mean, kids are curious. They ask questions. I think if it's a, we have to sit you down and have the convo, is when I hear about more kids having stronger reactions, because it feels like a big deal. And especially because many people wait till after a kid could start to comprehend it. So then sometimes it does feel like it's being hidden. Like when they're told at 16, hey, this is inherited. And you're like, okay, but I knew you had this for 5 years now. How is this only coming up now? You know, and like a 16-year-old smart enough to know, like, you could tell me that 13, even if you said it in a vague way and it's out there, but it wasn't a big topic. So I tend to default to that way. I mean, every kid is so different. Like some kids ask 1,000 questions, some kids ask 0 questions.
I might have a few thousand questions asked in my home.
But is that a...
No, it's not. It's not a bad thing at all. But what if they want to be I don't want to give them the right to make that decision right now, to be tested themselves. And I feel like, especially my son, he's going to say, like, I want to be tested right now. And he's 12. He thinks he's much older. But our medical system really doesn't want them tested if they don't have symptoms before they're 18.
I was going to say, yeah, the default in genetics is let a kid decide when they want to know, but within the scope of when is it relevant to them, right? So we don't typically test a newborn for something that won't affect them till they're an adult because they don't have the option to consent. It does get murky with some things like MITO, where you can show symptoms when you're younger. And so I have tested 12-year-olds for conditions that it's hard to tell if they have symptoms or not, but we think they might. And so they want to know if that's what's going on or not. But it's a discussion, right? And so usually it's a, hey, we can meet with your doctor and we can talk about what are the pros and cons of knowing. And they might say to you, we don't want to put that on your plate yet because we don't even know if the info we're telling you right now is super accurate, right? Like if I tell a 12-year-old, here are your reproductive options, those might not be their options in 10 years. Like, we don't know. And so that's part of it too, of like, if I tell you it as a newborn, this is the screening you're going to do as an adult, I don't want you holding on to that because by the time you make it to adulthood, we're probably going to have different screening options, right? And so that's part of it too. And I'll say that to kids. I'm like, I get that you really want to know. And maybe if you keep feeling that way for a while, we can revisit this. But I don't want to tell you something now that's going to be wrong in 5 years and freak you out for no reason. I also, if there's nothing we're going to do about it, I don't want to put that on your plate or make other doctors really worried about you and maybe not give you a med that they should or the opposite because they think it has to do with this when we don't have any proof of that. Like, I don't want to over-medicalize you. And we have that conversation a lot with things that are more concrete, like cancer. Like, you start at 25, you're screening. We're like, we're not testing you at 16 because it's a decade off. It is harder.
It feels more black and white.
Yeah, it's harder with MITO because you have no idea when.
Mm-hmm. As you said, there's a lot of flavors.
But again, that might mean that you test a 12-year-old if they start having symptoms of it. And sometimes I talk to a teenager who's like, I've assumed I just have it my whole life. Like, as far as I'm concerned, I have it. And they've thought that since they first found out about it, and now they're 16. And I'm like, okay, yeah, maybe for you, we will do testing. Like, 18 isn't a hard and fast line. Mm-hmm. We do test.
Okay. That's good to know.
It depends on the condition. It depends on the screening, all that other stuff. But sometimes it depends on the teenager. Like, some mm-hmm. teenagers are emancipated at 16, you know? And other teenagers are still freaking out about very mild things at 16. And we're like, this might be a high anxiety topic for you. So maybe we wait a couple more years, right? Like, just like adults, look at your friends. I have some friends that deal with news way differently than other friends, right? Like,
very true. Sam, how do you handle that Lydia doesn't have SMA? But your other kids do. that, I mean, that is also a concern of mine as well. Let's, whenever the day that we talk about it and when they get tested, I am very concerned that one of my kids will have it and the other does not.
So how we've explained it to Lydia is that there's the way that our genetics have worked is that, you know, there's genes that were expressed in the other kids that were not in her. And so because of that, you know, Nora and Aria have SMA. They got that gene that caused them to have SMA. It's a gene that, you know, they don't create the protein that helps keep their muscles from deteriorating. That's what SMA does. It takes that protein away. So then the muscles deteriorate over time instead of getting stronger. That's what SMA is in a nutshell. So what we said was, okay, so there was a certain chance. And because of the chances, she was one of the kids that just didn't have it. And she has another sister, Rosie, who doesn't have SMA, but Rosie's only 4. So she can't really understand that right now. And so we've just said, you know, that's just how it turned out. And so we've just explained that to her. Now for her, Nora was born when she was 18 months old. So she's never known Nora without her trach, without her ventilator, without her feeding tube, without any of her equipment. So for her, life is very normal like this. It's nothing that she's ever had to adjust to. There's nothing that she's, you know, it's never been different. So she doesn't know Nora any differently other than the fact that Nora learned how to talk at 3. And then now she talks as opposed to never, you know, she couldn't talk before. So it's just, we explained to her that, you know, when her dad and my genetics came together, that's just how things played out. And that's how we explained it.
Yeah. And I mean, I know she's
told the truth.
Well, but also like she has other stuff going on. So you're like, and I have seizures and you have seizures. And that's how that played out. Like, you know, I have autism. You maybe are on the spectrum. And
she knows she has autism. She's very aware of that.
Right. And like, again, there's other examples to use. Like for me and my brother both have it. It was a 1 in 4 chance for each of us. So 1 in 16, we both have it. People are like, do you wish that the other one didn't have it? And I'm like, well, yeah, it'd be great if my brother wasn't going through all of this stuff. But also, I'm really glad I have him. It's nice to have a friend who gets it. And so I get what you're saying of like, it'd be nice if your kids had someone else that gets it. If there's just 2 of them for you, Marcy, is it 2 kids, right?
Yes.
Okay, I thought so, but I was like, maybe I'm missing a third.
I mean, obviously, the worst case scenario is for both of them to have it, but it could also be very upsetting to both of them if one has it and one does not. There's a lot at play here. You know, there's been a lot of questions over the years of why did Grandma Ruthie die, and you know what happened to her body, and you know Grandma Andy's 71, and you know why did your mom's muscles not? You know, they're connecting a lot of dots.
Yeah. And kids do. That's the thing. They figure things out and they're a lot smarter than people think they are.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
I think they're very intuitive. And if you don't talk to them about things, they're going to figure it out.
Yeah.
And I think that's the hard part, is that you have to figure out how to have a conversation that's developmentally appropriate for them. And what's developmentally appropriate for one 12-year-old is not necessarily going to be appropriate for another 12-year-old. It all depends on the kid.
Well, and the reality is all of us, if we don't have an answer, we will fill the box, right? Like if we don't know why something happened, it's not human nature to want to be like, it was random. So most people come up with something, an explanation to put in the box. And you see it with everything, right? Someone has, why does someone get cancer and not someone else? People try to think of like, what other factors can we blame? Can we say, this is what happened? Kids do the same, right? Like if you don't tell a kid something, I've heard kids be like, well, she has it because she's blonde, but I'm brunette, so I don't, right? Like they try to
come out. Yeah, they're trying to figure it out.
Right? Like the same reason they're trying to figure out how do airplanes and clouds work, right? Like kids come up with wonderful answers for many things in life that may not be entirely accurate. That'll happen for this stuff too, though, right? Like,
yeah,
you know, your kids might come to you and go, well, you know, grandma, blah, 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 had blonde hair, so that must have been it. Or she lived in this state. And so sometimes having at least something in that box can kind of help with, again, you don't know what false assumptions
are. Right. I'm very open with talking to them. Specifically something like my back pain, which is a big issue for me. I'm open about it. I think it's easy to speak just on that, and compartmentalize, tell them I go to physical therapy. If you knew me as a mother, you know, in my community, like I'm really open with my kids. I'm not a closed book. I'm not digging my head in the sand. I'm doing everything I can to stay healthy myself. I think about the worry I had. I worried about money. I worried about my mom's health. I worried about any time she was late that, you know, her condition slowed her down a lot. So did she have a fall? Did she get in a car accident? You know, it was all of that. And I just don't want that to develop. And even if I told my kids of my condition, I wouldn't obviously talk about what my fears were when I was a kid. But, you know, it's a tough topic. It's heavy. And I appreciate you guys digging into it today.
And again, there isn't a right answer.
No, right? There's not a right answer. I want our listeners to really know that.
You know, and you can sprinkle it in and you can have the best laid plan. Get your little ducks in a row for the convo. And the kid's like, scatter the ducks. Let's have chaos instead.
Right.
You know, and that's, I think, the hard part, too, with anything with genetics. We like to feel like things are concrete. We like to think that, like, we know everything there is to know about this, that if you do this, then that will happen. If I plan this conversation, if I wait till this age, then blank.
And yeah, I don't know what I'm waiting for. I don't.
But it's human nature, right? Like, we like structure. We like things to be predictable. Yeah. A lot of life isn't, and that's hard to deal with. And we know that. We probably have more anxieties than kids do because we know a lot.
Right.
Again, your kid's also going to have anxiety over the crayon. So
right.
If they have a reaction, that doesn't mean you did something wrong.
Yes.
And that's, I think, the hard reminder, too.
I think that's really good advice. If they have a reaction, it doesn't mean that I made a wrong choice.
No, and there's also going to be feelings. I mean, your kids are going to have feelings, and it doesn't mean you did wrong, and it's okay to give them space to feel those feelings. I think it's very important to let them feel those feelings, however they may play out. You know, they might have some very big feelings about that. And I think for many of us, especially in like the millennial age, we were told to just kind of stuff our feelings and not feel them. And I feel like that's one thing as parents that we've changed, is that we let our kids feel those feelings and give them a safe place to feel them. And I think that that's so important as parents and just as people to do, is just to give space for those feelings and just realize that, yeah, it's okay if you're a little bit upset about it, but let's talk about it afterwards. Like, let me feel your feelings. If you need a little space, that's fine. Let's come back and talk about it. You know, it doesn't need to be this big, long conversation. We can do it in steps, however it looks for your family. You know, it's not a cut and dry sort of deal, and it can be individual, and it has to be.
And if you don't want to talk to me, you can talk to someone else. You can talk to a counselor. You can talk to a therapist. Like,
right.
I see this so much with young adult males, especially. The parents are like, please have them call you. And it's like, I can't make them call me. Boys do what they want. But I can make them know that they can call me and talk to me without their mom there and have that space if they want it. Or Sam and I participate in a lot of like young adult support groups for Mito, for like teens and stuff. One of the main rules is parents aren't allowed. So they can have a space, feel the feels, and say the things that maybe their mom wouldn't want to hear them say, right? And like, that's fine. Like, they should be allowed to be like, I'm mad, or I'm sad, or I coped by sneaking a beer. And you're like, okay, well, that's not great. But you need a space to talk about the things that aren't the perfect reaction. And again, there's so many different options for that. Is it a professional? Is it a friend? Is it a neighbor? Is it someone through a charity? Is it your local religious group? Like, there's lots of options. each kid's going to want a totally different selection from the menu, right? Like,
right, right.
Yeah.
But it's important to give them that menu.
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
All emotions are valid. There is no right decision. How we doing, kid? And right? Like, try to not ask yes or no questions, right? Like,
right.
Open-ended questions and see what they fill in, because it might be totally different than what you were thinking.
Right. You both are so smart. And Devin, we're going to have you on a few times throughout 2025. And I really appreciate you both being on Energy in Action. There's so much to talk about when it comes to this crazy disease. I like what you said about how there's so many flavors. I'm going to use that. And there's a lot of layers on how to handle it all and what makes sense for whom. And I think it's important to really dig in and to talk about all of it. So I'm good talking about it. I don't know why. I can't do it with them. I'm not sure what it is, but I promise when I make that decision, I'll make an episode about that, right? So
we have meta emotions. We have feelings about our feelings, right?
Yeah.
You'll bad over the fact that you feel stressed about it, right?
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
A lot to process. It's not simple. And
Right. Yeah,
sometimes it's our own baggage, guilt or emotions or other things. And other times it's stuff that we don't even know what was planted in our brain when we were kids about how you should or shouldn't talk about things. And I always say it's easier to plant something in your brain than to root it out, right? Those little things people planted when we were kids that we weren't even aware they planted. As adults, we have to spend years yanking them out of our brain.
Right. For sure.
And that doesn't mean there's something wrong with you, that was planted then. Doesn't make you good or bad, but you're still stuck dealing with it.
Right. Well, thank you both so much for being on Energy in Action. It has been so wonderful talking with you. You've given me a lot to think about myself and hopefully for a lot of our listeners as well. And I wish you both the best in your own journeys. And hopefully we'll have both of you on at different points. But Devin, we do have some plans for you throughout this year as a regular guest, we'll call you. So thank you both so much.
Yeah, thank you.
It was a great conversation.
It was a great conversation.
Thank you for joining us. I encourage you to browse other Energy in Action podcast episodes. I am so inspired by the resilience of those in previous episodes, and I know you will be too.